TUC Radio San Francisco. Time of useful consciousness. Just 3 days prior to the ministerial meeting of the World Trade Organization in Seattle in early December 1999, the International Forum on Globalization, the IFG, held a teach-in. In an attempt to remove the veil of secrecy surrounding the proceedings of the WTO, the IFG had brought in speakers from Asia, India, Europe, Africa, as well as South and North America. No other organization has so consistently alerted the public to the risks and consequences of the provisions of the Global Trade Agreement. At 7 prior teach-ins in that many years, the IFG has warned early on that the mission of the WTO is to diminish our power to make laws about public health, food safety, the environment, labor standards, and even culture, while creating a set of rules that shift power from nation states to multinational corporations. Today's program brings you Susan George. She spoke at the festive opening session of the teach-in on Friday, November 26th. She is one of the best-known and respected writers on third world debt and a rare guest to her home country. She now lives and works in Paris. In Europe, she is well known as the outspoken campaigner in opposition to the free trade model of Maastricht, the European Union, and the MAI. She is a prolific writer with several books on the third world debt crisis. Two of her books, A Fate Worse Than Debt and The Debt Boomerang, are the definitive works on the misery imposed on the third world by debt to multilateral lending agencies. A recent book with Fabrizio Sabelli, Faith and Credit, is a critique of the World Bank, Robert McNamara, and the arrogance of the globalization elites. Susan George.
This is absolutely fantastic. And we're going to have intellectual and political fireworks, so bless you all. You've done a terrific job. You've heard of the Battle of Lexington and Concord. You've heard of the Battle of Gettysburg. You've heard of D-Day. Well, this is the Battle of Seattle. And it's just as much a historical turning point as any previous battle in the history of this country or any other. And I'm not using the idea of a battle or a war as just a metaphor or an image. I think we are really at war. Not all of us perhaps are aware of this, but everything fits. As in other wars, there's an objective. It's the control of the world, the world's wealth. It's an objective of power. You don't need tanks and missiles necessarily to carry out a war. You can use other methods. And if you want access to all world resources, whether financial or material or natural or human, obviously you're going to have to fight for that. So here we've got an adversary, we've got an enemy, which is the whole corporate system. And the objective of that corporate system, whether financial or industrial, is to be able to go where it wants and produce what it wants, when it wants, for as long as it wants, and to make as much money, obviously, as it can, and damn the costs. The goal is profit. And anything that enhances that goal is good. And anything that goes against that goal is bad. Now, you notice that in this model, there's absolutely nothing about employment. There's nothing, obviously, about social justice, about the environment, any of those things. Those are just side effects. Of course, corporations do employ people, but that is not their purpose. Their purpose is profit, period. But transnationals have to have rules. Any system has to have rules. Even the mafia has rules. And the rules that they want are the ones that they are attempting to write, and to some degree they have been successful. I think they need three things. They need the freedom of capital movements. That is something that the IMF takes care of. The IMF imposes its law on countries in the South and now the East, and it insists that capital be free to cross their borders in all directions. This, of course, leads to financial crises, to collapse. We'll be hearing more about that in the course of this evening and tomorrow. And the IMF has been able to put those laws into effect because countries have been so indebted. That's one set of rules. They wanted freedom of investment. And that is what they were trying to get through the multilateral agreement on investment, through the MAI. And they were absolutely stunned when popular movements defeated the MAI. Stunned. Stunned. Stunned and mad as hell. And don't think it's not going to come back if they have anything to say about it, because it is. That's one of the things that is likely to be, in one way or another, on the agenda of the WTO. Not necessarily as a freestanding agreement on investment, but they can get what they want also through the TRIMS agreement and through the services agreement. And then they need a third set of freedoms, which is, of course, the movement of goods and services. And that's what the GATT took care of at one point, and now it's the WTO with much more forceful means of ensuring those freedoms. Everything in the world and every aspect of human activity is defined as tradable. All our activities are objects of trade. Agriculture, natural resources, life forms, services alone, it's 11 different sectors, including health and education and environment, as Maud told us, and 160 subsectors. I don't care what your job is or what industry you are in, what you're working on, I will bet you that it can be found under the rules of the WTO. Transnational corporations control directly or indirectly two-thirds of all world trade. It's a misnomer to speak of trade, because if you have one-third of all exchanges that are taking place between affiliates of the same corporation, IBM trading with IBM, Ford trading with Ford, and that's the case for one-third or more of all world trade. That can't be called trade. A further third of what is called trade takes place between the affiliates of different transnational corporations. In other words, anything that could be called national trade is a very shrinking and small part of the total. And the rules of the 18th century simply cannot be applied to this. You can't talk about comparative advantage the way Adam Smith or David Ricardo did in the 20th century. It simply doesn't apply. But they want a rule-based system, and they, of course, want to make those rules. And if you think I'm exaggerating, just let me give you the alphabet soup of the different coalitions that have been coaching all of our negotiators at the WTO and previously at the GATT. You've got the TABD, that means the Transatlantic Business Dialogue. That's industries from both sides of the Atlantic. They just had a meeting in Berlin. They called our commissioner for Europe, Pascal Lamy, to that meeting in order to give him, and I quote, detailed recommendations. You've got the U.S. Council on International Business. You've got the U.S. Council of Service Industries, Coalition, of Service Industries, which is telling Mrs. Barshefsky what she is to do at the negotiations. One of the things she's supposed to do is to attack the public services in Europe, particularly health, because the healthcare industry in the United States wants to get at our nationalized health systems and particularly wants to get what they call the market of the over 65s. That's part of Mrs. Barshefsky's instructions. You've got the European Roundtable of Industrialists, the ERT, 45 presidents of the most powerful firms in Europe who are having, they have their office in Brussels, they are coaching the negotiators all the time. You've got the European Service Leaders Group. In other words, these people are there, they are making the rules, and they are telling the negotiators what to do. I don't agree that deregulation is a legitimate word. I think that it is a false word, a trap, and that what is really going on is re-regulation. There are rules that are being written all the time, but these rules are being written of, by, and for the corporations. Now let me come to the WTO. These rules tell us that we don't need the precautionary principle. These rules tell us that we can have child labor. They tell us that the multilateral agreements on the environment don't count and that WTO law supersedes those agreements. They tell us that genetically manipulated organisms are good for our health, that hormone beef is delicious, and that Europe can't have a foreign policy because it was giving preferential treatment to the bananas produced by the African, Caribbean, and Pacific countries. No, we have to import Chiquita brand bananas on the same terms. In other words, we have to scrap the Lomé Convention. The polluter pays principle is outlawed as well. These are the rules that are being written by these corporations. And for a long time, all of this seemed extremely technical, remote. People were not catching on to what was happening. When the GATT was transformed into the WTO in 1994, there were some sporadic protests, but people didn't understand what was happening, and even worse, our elective representatives didn't have a clue as to what was happening. But now something really is happening, and suddenly this isn't working. These corporations who want a perfect world, they want a utopia for transnationals, and nothing for consumers, for labor, for health, for education, and especially for democracy. Well, they're creating the opposite of a utopia. And I looked it up. It's a dystopia, D-Y-S. A dystopia is what they are actually creating. Any war requires propaganda. And part of their propaganda is to put the slogan of free trade ahead of everything else. Free always sounds good. And if you're a protectionist, anything with an ist at the end or an ism at the end is bad news, right? A protectionist is somebody, I don't know why, because it seems okay to me to protect your family, to protect your children, to protect your country. But suddenly, this is a bad thing to be. Part of the propaganda is also that the market knows best. It's all-seeing, it's all-knowing. The market is going to be able to be the most efficient allocator of all resources, whether they're human, natural, or our knowledge, or industrial resources. There's absolutely no evidence that trade is linked with growth or greater welfare. No empirical evidence, but they proceed as if this were a given. But suddenly, their dream of making universal rules is breaking down. And that's because they forgot just one thing. They forgot about the people. And that's why That's why we're fighting the Battle of Seattle. If the enemy is transnational and is going for total control, then I think it's obvious that the response has also got to be transnational, and it's got to be a mix of people. We don't want totalitarianism. That's not our goal. We want international democracy. But if we're to get it, we've got to fight for each other. We've got to fight for each other. The threat is to all of us, but we can't fight against these threats individually. Yes, the farmer, the family farm, they are threatened. They are threatened by mass exports and by cheap cereals. The Canadian farmers of the north now are losing their prices, as Maud said, are where they were in 1926. But if the farmer fights only for agriculture in the WTO, that won't work. Filmmakers and authors, yes, were threatened by the TRIPS agreement and the cultural provisions, but getting a cultural exception, the way the French government seems to think it's useful, that isn't going to work. Yes, the environment is gravely threatened, but ecologists won't save it by fighting only for environmental protection. And yes, the North-South gap is becoming a chasm, but we won't close it simply by demanding special and differential treatment for the South. Yes, labor rights and wages are being forced down everywhere, but unions are not going to protect working people by fighting only for a social clause when all other aspects of the WTO favor privatization and they make ceilings and not floors. In other words, if we're not fighting each for all for each, we're going to be picked off one by one. Now, if you're in a war, and I want to convince you that we are in a war, you've got to think about who your allies are also. Our government's allies. Well, I'm very sorry to say that it's a rare government that's an ally in this struggle. There's a permanent government, the pacts you got coming in say an invisible government, and that's true. But there's also a permanent government, which is the government of the industrial and financial corporations. And then every now and then we're allowed to elect men in suits, they mostly are men, who read the script. They read the script for the permanent government. And the state seems to be accepting its own demise. I don't know what the reason for that is. We struggled with this contradiction during the anti-MAI struggle. Why were our governments prepared to give up so much and get absolutely nothing in return? And the only answer I could think of is contained in a document that's 150 years old, and it says the state is the permanent committee for running the general affairs of the bourgeoisie. I'm sure that you noticed the reference. I don't expect I have to give you the reference on that. But we're at the point now where you can rent a government the way the American government was rented by Chiquita Brands and, of course, brought suit in the WTO. You don't have to do it directly. You don't have to have the investor-to-state dispute resolution the way it was outlined in the MAI. No, you can do it through governments. And our governments seem to be willing to give up their sovereignty and have great pleasure in doing so. Do we have allies in the UN system or in any place in the international system? Well, there again, the news is pretty bad. I have it on absolute authority, and I cannot tell you what my source is for obvious reasons, but last week, Mike Moore telephoned Mrs. Brundtland, who is the head of the World Health Organization, and he said, I've got enough on my plate as it is, and enough problems, and I don't want the World Health Organization raising any questions about genetically manipulated organisms or about AIDS medicines in South Africa or in Thailand, and Mrs. Brundtland accepted not to bring up any of these subjects. No, this is true. I am very sorry to say it, but this is true. We've got several of the UN agencies that are now making alliances with these corporations. The UNDP has got its Global Sustainable Development Facility, where no matter who you are, you can be the worst human rights violator, like Rio Tinto Zinc. If you pay $50,000, you can use the UN flag and the UN logo. And we've got Kofi Annan, who is helping to sponsor the Geneva Business Dialogue with the president of Nestle. We're calling him now, some of us who are not very respectful, we're calling him Nescoffee. I want to quote our commissioner. We've got a new commission in Europe, and the trade commissioner is supposed to be a French socialist. I don't know how he got that label. He's replaced Sir Leon Britton, who was too conservative even for Margaret Thatcher. And Pascal Lamy says that, well, Britton's program was really a very, very good program. And this is what he says. He says in the Financial Times, the fallout from a breakdown, he's speaking about the negotiations here, the fallout from a breakdown could be serious. If some NGOs thought they had succeeded in destroying further liberalization, we'd be confronted with a real problem. So I want to invite you all to create a real problem for Pascal Lamy. But he says something else. He says something else. Not moving forward in economic matters doesn't make sense. Economics is a world where you always move forward. You never stop. Trade is based on the same sort of law. Well, maybe we should be moving forward, but certainly not on that road. We've got to stop and turn around. And we've got to do nothing less than overthrow the permanent government of the transnational corporations. This is difficult. This is difficult. This is difficult, and we shouldn't hide from ourselves the difficulty, because we've got to make a huge leap towards common action, which transcends not just nationality, which is already hard enough, but we did a pretty good job of that during the MAI struggle. But we've also got to transcend all the other boundaries, all the boundaries of age, of class, of race, of gender, all special interests. Because we can win if we pledge ourselves to each other. Because history is handing us an enormous opportunity, and we've got to seize it. We are the actors who can create a real victory for international democracy. And we're going to start doing that tonight against the WTO. Thank you.
That was Susan George, director of the Transnational Institute and a past director of Greenpeace International. She is now president of the Observatoire de la Mondialisation. She spoke at the teach-in of the International Forum on Globalization in Seattle on November 26, 1999. There she shared the stage with 8 other speakers, among them Maud Barlow, who chairs the 100,000-member-strong Council of Canadians. Maud Barlow is a major public figure in Canada and is often called Canada's Ralph Nader. She has been a leading campaigner against the U.S.-Canada Free Trade Agreement and NAFTA and the Multilateral Agreement on Investment, the MAI. The tape you can get with Susan George's talk includes Maud Barlow's moving appeal to protect the world's dwindling supply of fresh water.
Here is a brief excerpt of what she had to say in last week's program. Maud Barlow.
Everything is now for sale. Even those areas of life that we once considered sacred, like health and education, food and water and air and seeds and gene and a heritage. It is all now for sale. Economic freedom, not democracy, and not ecological stewardship is the defining metaphor of the WTO. And its central goal is humanity's mastery of the natural world through its total commodification. Now, I want to take my few minutes here tonight to sound the alarm about one aspect of this. You're going to hear so many different areas of concern around the WTO, but I want to talk about the potential impact of the WTO on the very source of life, which is water. The destruction of aquatic ecosystem health and the increasing water scarcity are, in my opinion, the most pressing environmental problems facing humankind. The first myth to counter is that there is a lot of water to go around. We're treating it badly, but there's lots of water. This is not true. The amount of fresh water available in the world is only 0.5% of the total world's water stock. And every year that needs to stretch to welcome 85 million new people into the world. Yet we are depleting, diverting, and polluting that finite supply at an astonishing rate. Today, 31 countries are facing water stress and scarcity, and over 1 billion people lack access to clean drinking water. We know that 5 million people, most of them children, die every year from illnesses caused by poor drinking water. If we do not change our ways, by the year 2025, as much as 2/3 of the world will be living in either water scarcity or total water deprivation. This is the major environmental crisis of our time. Groundwater overpumping and aquifer depletion are now an urgent problem in the world's most intensive agriculture areas, and water is being depleted many, many times faster than nature can replenish it. This means that instead of living on water income, we are now living on water capital, and we are facing water bankruptcy. The global expansion in mining and manufacturing is increasing the threat of pollution, and these underground water supplies are contaminating aquifers all over the world. 90% of most of the world's communities still dump their raw sewage directly into the waterways of the world. At the same time, overexploitation of the planet's major river systems is threatening another finite source of water. From the Nile in Egypt, to the Ganges in South Asia, to the Yellow River in China, and the Colorado in America, these are just some of the major rivers that no longer reach the sea. Agribusiness, growing crops for export, is claiming more and more of the water once used by family and peasant farmers for food self-sufficiency, and industry is creeping up the major river systems, drinking them dry as they go.
That was Maud Barlow, National Chair of the Council of Canadians and prolific author of books on trade and education. TUC Radio is supported by listeners like you. A one-hour copy of the talks by Susan George and Maud Barlow is $10. A transcript is $7. Send your check to TUC Radio, Box 41009, San Francisco, California, 94141. That's TUC Radio, Box 410009, San Francisco, California, 94141, USA. For a credit card order, call TUC Radio toll-free at 1-877-TUC-TAPE. That's 877-TUC-TAPE. The music is by G.S. Sarstef. My name is Mariah Gallardin. Thank you for listening.